Please open your Bibles to the book of Esther. We're going to be starting in chapter 1, verse 1 in just a moment. 2 weeks ago, when we last met in this class, we went over an introduction to the book of Esther. And if you were not here for that class, that might be something worthwhile for you to get off of the internet at thywordistruth.com. You could watch a video of the class or listen to the audio or read the notes. Because a lot of the things that we talk about as we go through Esther will have to do with the introduction that we gave earlier. One of the themes of Esther, as we discussed in the introduction, is the theme of feasting, or the theme of banquets. And true to that theme, the book of Esther begins with a banquet in chapter 1, given by the great King Xerxes. And in fact, this banquet is going to lead to a series of events that is going to allow Esther to enter the scene. So we're going to see this is a very important feast with regards to what happens later in the book. It's interesting if you look at all of the biblical women, the women in the Bible, most of them are renowned because of what their sons did, because they gave birth to sons who did great things for Israel. You think of Sarah, you think of Rebecca, you think of Hannah. Certainly they were faithful on their own, but part of the reason they're in the Scripture is because they gave birth to someone who was very important in God's plan of redemption. If you think about the other book in the Bible named for a woman, Ruth, that's true of her, certainly. She's among the ancestry of King David. But with Esther, we come to someone who is in the Bible because of what she did, because of her courage and her faithfulness. So let's begin then in the book of Esther, chapter 1, verse 1. And let me remind you also, I won't have time to read the text as we talk about what it means. So it's important, if you have the time, to read through the book of Esther before we meet for class each time. This is one of those accounts in here that I think we're all very familiar with. But sometimes it's the ones we're most familiar with that we're sometimes a little surprised about when we take the time to really dive into it, into what it's really saying. So that's probably true about the events in Esther. I'm sure we're all familiar with them to some degree. Verse 1 begins with the phrase, "This is what happened during," or "now in the days of," depending upon the translation you're using. That's the same kind of introduction that you find in the books of Joshua and Judges. Those who argue this book is not historical, as we talked about in the introduction, they have to admit this book presents itself as history. It starts off with the exact same phrase that we see in the books of history. And they also have to explain why their reasoning as to Esther, that it's not history, wouldn't also apply to Joshua and Judges. It begins the same way. They present themselves the same way. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew form of the Persian king called Xerxes. That's what I'll usually call him, Xerxes, even though the translations very often use the Hebrew form of his name. We saw him briefly in Ezra chapter 4, verse 6, very briefly. He reigned from 486 to 465. His father was Darius the Great. And he inherited from Darius a great Persian empire extending from India to Ethiopia, which is what verse 1 tells us, and history also confirms that. That was the largest empire known up until that time, and that's what Xerxes inherited from his father. Susa had been the capital of ancient Elam, and that's where the events are going to take place here in the book of Esther. If you have your handout, you'll see the ruins of Susa, which you can go visit today if you're brave enough to venture into Turkey, that is. But it is still there and can be visited. The very places where these events are occurring, the very buildings, the foundations of the palace and the banquet hall that we're looking at here, you can go see today. Darius rebuilt it and used it as his main residence until he moved to Persepolis. Xerxes also used it as a main residence. Daniel had a vision at Susa in Daniel chapter 8. Nehemiah served in Susa as the cupbearer to Xerxes' son, Artaxerxes, in Nehemiah 1, verse 1. Xerxes ascended to the throne at the age of 32. The third year of his reign, which we see here as the time, would have been 3 years before his famous expedition to Greece that we talked about in the introduction. That expedition to Greece is not mentioned in the book of Esther, but it's an undercurrent throughout the book of Esther. And we're going to see that as we study these events. It's running underneath the surface of this book. The rulers would use a banquet to show their greatness and to repay their friends. Herodotus describes banquets with as many as 15,000 guests. Another had 70,000 guests. So these were big events. If you go to the Louvre Museum in Paris today, they have a room devoted to things that have been recovered from Susa. And one of the things you'll see at the Louvre is a huge colored mosaic that was up on the wall. And that mosaic was up on the wall at the time these events were taking place. That's a mosaic that Esther and the King Xerxes would have seen as they were in the palace at the time these events are taking place. And you can visit that in the Louvre Museum. Verses 4 through 8 tell us about the splendor of this king. Persia's wealth and magnificence dazzled even Alexander the Great. When more than a century later, he entered this palace at Susa and found 1,200 tons of gold and silver bullion and 270 tons of gold coins. And in fact, if you look at your handout, you'll see the treasury, the foundations of the treasury. That's where that was all stored and where Alexander the Great found that. The same critics who complain about the things we talked about in the introduction also complain about the 180-day banquet in verse 4. They say, well, no feast would have lasted 180 days. But the language doesn't say the feast lasted that long, does it? More likely, Xerxes had some kind of a public exhibition that lasted half a year. When we get around to the feast, verse 5 tells us it lasted only 7 days. This may have also been a time of planning for that Greek expedition that I just mentioned. Xerxes was about to march into Greece and try to conquer Greece, and this was a time of planning for that. It would have come at the perfect time for a great war council that Herodotus tells us about in 483. I think that was what we're seeing here. And in fact, we see that he had his important men at this banquet. He had the army and the captains were here with him. I think what we're seeing here is the great war council that led up to that expedition to Greece. Herodotus tells us about it and says, Xerxes opened it up by saying, "For this cause I have now summoned you together that I may impart to you my purpose." He was getting them all on his side, getting them ready to go with him to war. And if so, it was very important that he display his wealth and display his power because he wanted them to know he could make good on his promises. And with that backdrop, we're about to find out what Vashti did to him and refusing to come down to him during this banquet. So think about those events as we're talking here about the importance of this banquet to the king, the importance of this banquet to him with regard to the Greek expedition. Verses 6 through 7 describe the incredible luxury of the Persian palace. Herodotus tells us about an incident during the Greek campaign when Xerxes was retreating. And that tells you a little bit about how that campaign went, but I don't want to jump ahead. But Herodotus is telling us about his retreat, and the Greeks came up to one of his tents that he had to leave behind in a hurry. And inside that abandoned tent, they found gold and silver couches, furniture made out of gold and silver in the tents of King Xerxes. They were astonished at that, and Herodotus says they wondered why such a rich Persian king would want to conquer Greece. The word edict or law in verse 8, it's used 19 times in this book, each time with regard to a royal edict. Now, usually at one of these feasts, there would be someone called a toastmaster, and he would determine when people would drink, and it would be kind of an organized drinking. But here it says they could drink whenever they wanted to, which I think tells us this was not just a luxurious feast, it was a licentious feast as well, drunken revelry at this feast. These introductory verses emphasize one of the key themes in the book of Esther. It's a theme we talked about in the introduction, and that's the theme of reversal. The theme of reversal. Everyone who read this book originally knew that as they read chapter 1, they knew how these events were going to turn out. They're reading about the incredible luxury of King Xerxes. They're reading about his great war council. They know he's about to march off to Greece. And they know that would be a dismal failure, that he would come back with his treasury depleted and he would come back with his power depleted. They know that as they read chapter 1. So already in their mind is going the theme of reversal because they know Xerxes is going to have a huge reversal in his life. They see that coming. And there's yet another hint of the reversal as we read these opening verses. The elaborate description of this foreign palace is unusual in the Bible. In fact, the only description of a temple that receives similar treatment is the temple at Jerusalem, which we know God goes into great detail to describe its beauty and its splendor. And you have to wonder if the author is not in a very subtle way saying, look, Jews, you were over here and you had a beautiful, splendorous temple. And now you're over here and that splendor has come to Persia. And you yourself have had a great reversal, haven't you? Because you have stepped down. True, the temple had been rebuilt by this time. But as we've already said, it was rebuilt on much less a grand scale. So I think there's yet another subtle hint of a reversal that we see just in these opening verses. And we're going to see reversals throughout the book of Esther. Verse 9 tells us about the queen's banquet. And the fact that she gives one tells us she had liberty to make such decisions and to take such actions. And we're going to later see Queen Esther has similar powers. Herodotus tells us that the name of Xerxes' queen was Amestris. And many point to that as a historical discrepancy. But we've already talked about that a little bit. I think it's a possibility that this is Amestris, and she just had two different names. We're about to see that Esther herself has two different names in this book. Also, Vashti means sweetheart. So some suggest that it may have just been an epithet that the king used when talking about Queen Amestris. It is known that Amestris was the mother of the next king, Artaxerxes I. And in fact, she served as the queen mother. So in fact, if she was the queen mother during her son's reign, she came back onto the scene after being exiled by her husband, Xerxes. One reason Herodotus only mentions her may be that Herodotus really is only interested in those queens that bore successors to the throne. And we see that in other examples. Esther apparently did not, so that may be one reason why he did not mention Esther. Verses 10 through 12 describe a command from the king, and they describe the queen's denial of that command. Verse 4 tells us that Xerxes wanted to display his splendor and his glory. We've already talked about why he wanted to do that. It was very important to him. And the beautiful Queen Vashti, appearing with her royal crown, would have been a living trophy of that splendor and that glory. And that's why he wanted her to come. Why did he send 7 eunuchs to go and get her? Well, I think the eunuch part is self-explanatory. Why 7? Well, some suggest it may have taken 7 to carry her down on her royal litter. She probably wouldn't have just walked in. She would have been carried in on this royal litter. In any event, they're mentioned here by name, which I think also attests to the historical nature of this text. Herodotus tells us something very interesting about alcohol, about drinking in this Persian time. Persian kings drank alcohol when they were deliberating matters of state. Herodotus says, it is the Persians' custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk, and what they approve in their councils is proposed to them the next day by the master of the house where they deliberate. When they are now sober, and if being sober they still approve it, they act thereon. But if not, they cast it aside. And when they have taken counsel about a matter when sober, they decide upon it when they are drunk. The ancients believed intoxication kind of put them in touch with the spiritual world. And if Herodotus is correct here, then this drinking would have been an essential element of Xerxes' war council. And yet another historical fact confirmed in the book of Esther, isn't it? A key event in the book of Esther occurs in verse 12. Queen Vashti refuses to come down to Xerxes, the most powerful man on earth at this time, and she refuses. Why? The rabbi said it was because the king wanted her to appear before him naked, wearing only the royal crown, but the text doesn't say that. We do know, however, that coming to show herself to these royal princes and these army people would have caused her to come unveiled. And that would have meant doing so before a large crowd of drunken men. So that's another possibility. That's another possibility why she refused. Another possibility may just be the providence of God. We know it's very important to God's plan that Queen Vashti exit the stage. And so for whatever reason, she does not come down. In any event, it was a courageous act on her part. Some might say foolhardy, but it was courageous, and she paid the price for that courage. She defied her king and her husband by refusing to shame herself in public, which is what I think most commentators agree was the reason here. She was willing to give up her status, give up her power in order to do what was right, remembering that she was a pagan. She's not Jewish. She's Persian. But we're going to see Queen Esther making a similar courageous stand later in chapter 5. We do, though, have another very subtle message here in this account. This all-powerful, mighty king was not in charge. He was not getting his way. Instead, rightness was in charge because she was refusing to come down to this drunken feast. So we're already seeing a very important question asked here in Esther. Who is really in charge? And who should be obeyed? And at what cost? We're already seeing those questions asked here. These verses are doing more than just providing an explanation for why Esther is going to come onto the scene. These verses are showing us glimpses of the central themes in the book of Esther. Verse 12 tells us that King Xerxes became enraged, and we can picture that. One reason for his great wrath was no doubt the refusal had occurred in front of his nobles and in front of his generals. He was trying to impress these people about his great power. He wanted to lead them to war against Greece, and he could not even get his own wife to obey him here in the opening chapter. What we see here is the inner weakness of this king already. Although outwardly very powerful, he's already having trouble here in chapter 1. One reason Vashti's decision took such courage was that she no doubt knew what kind of man Xerxes was. She knew him, and yet she still made this refusal. History records a number of events attesting to Xerxes' instability. Perhaps the strangest of all was his punishment of the ocean. That strange event is described in the following text I will read to you from a 1913 history book I found. Darius was succeeded by his son Xerxes, under whom the war with Greece was carried to a disastrous climax. Xerxes was accounted the handsomest man of his time, but proved also the most feeble. He was as idle and foolish as his father had been active and wise. Inexperienced in warfare, Xerxes planned an expedition of numbers so vast that he expected them completely to overwhelm the rebellious Greeks. It was not easy for the Persian army to travel all the way to far-off Greece, and Xerxes was weary of the march before it even started. When at length his forces reached the strait that separated Asia from Europe, a bridge of ships was built from shore to shore. A storm swept them away. And Xerxes showed his petty wrath by commanding his soldiers to give the sea 300 lashes with whips, as though it were a human slave. That's the person that Queen Vashti said no to. Herodotus also tells us that Xerxes once beheaded all of the workers on a bridge because the bridge had been delayed by bad weather. That was the person Vashti openly defied and embarrassed. So for whatever reason she did that, we have to agree it was courageous. Now, while we generally view Queen Vashti as heroic and noble, that is not the case with all commentators. And because the book of Esther does not reveal her motives, there is some ambiguity about why she did what she did. And in fact, we're going to encounter the same kind of ambiguity when we get to Esther herself. The Bible does not tell us her motives. Many ancient and Jewish Christians both villainized Vashti as a wicked and rebellious woman for refusing to obey her husband. Even Martin Luther used Vashti as a negative example when he wrote about divorce, at one point urging husbands in some situations to, quote, take an Esther and let Vashti go, close quote. But verse 10 to me seems to be the key verse here, because it suggests that Vashti's refusal had something to do with the king's drunkenness. And if we start from that premise, I think we conclude that Vashti was doing something right here by refusing to go down to that drunken feast. One other possibility I saw is that if you put the dates together of when Artaxerxes was born, her son, the next king, It's very possible that, and if this was a mistress, if Vashti was the same as a mistress, and if Artaxerxes then was her son, she could have been in the late stages of pregnancy when this occurred. That's another possibility. One reason Esther is such an incredibly interesting book is that it does not tell us, in many cases, why the people involved did the things they did. It doesn't tell us what was going through their minds. It leaves that for us to determine based upon how we're seeing them act and how we see them, what we see them do. We're invited to reach our own conclusions. And while most of us view Vashti and even Esther in a positive light, others do not. And we'll see that with Esther when we get to her in a moment. The Greeks came along much later and rewrote this book. When they translated it, they also just added a bunch of stuff. And the Greeks added in what the people were thinking or what they thought they were thinking. You know, we've already talked about how God's name is absent in this book. Well, not when the Greeks got through with it. They put it in. They completely rewrote the book of Esther. And it suffered. It suffered in that attempt to rewrite it and add in. It's intentional that the author has not told us that. He's inviting us to look into the account, look at their actions, and determine what was going through their minds. Verses 13 through 15, the king discusses what had happened. He discusses this with his counselors. It was customary for a Persian king to have these counselors. It was also customary to have them killed when they told him things he didn't want to hear, as Darius II and Cambyses did with their counselors. In verse 15, the king asked them what he should do. Ezra 7, verse 14, also speaks of the king's seven counselors. Herodotus confirms the king had seven counselors. These counselors could come into his presence unannounced, uninvited. These seven could do that. Verse 13 says they knew the times. That means they used astrology. That means they used divination. That's what that idiom means. They knew the times. Verses 16 through 18 describe the seriousness of Vashti's offense in their eyes and in the eyes of the king. Memucan, one of the advisors, explains that this wasn't just an offense against you, King Xerxes. This was an offense against all husbands, because they're going to hear about what the king did, and suddenly all of our wives are going to be acting in this rebellious way. And this was actually very clever on Memucan's part, because what did this do? This gave the king an opportunity to react, but not out of personal animosity, not out of personal capriciousness. When he acted, he was acting as if, oh, I'm doing this for all the other husbands in the realm. That's why I'm going to banish Vashti. It's not like I'm just a petty tyrant. I'm doing it for all the others. And that Memucan's, what he said to the king, allowed the king to make that decision. So it was actually very clever. Verses 19 through 22 describe the queen's punishment and the king's decree. For her punishment, she would lose her royal position and never be allowed to come before the king again. Verse 19 says that in her place, we would put someone who is better than she. A little foreshadowing there of what was to come. Notice for the first time in this book, Queen Vashti is referred to simply as Vashti in verse 19. She has experienced a reversal. The irrevocability of the king's command. We see that in verse 19. We're going to see it later in this book. We also see it in Daniel, where Cyrus's governor was manipulated into issuing an irrevocable decree that no one pray to God. And we remember how that turned out. Now, many critics complain that there is no extra biblical evidence for such irrevocable decrees. And in fact, they also say it's hard to imagine a legal system which does not allow for emendation of its laws. And we can't find it anywhere. Okay, well, the first thing I would have to add is it that hard for us to conceive of this situation that it's impossible or maybe even difficult to repeal a law? I mean, we see that in our own headlines. Also, we've already seen an account in Ezra that showed us that if the law is worded correctly, it can be changed. Remember the law we talked about that said you can't rebuild right now, but he said, I might change my mind later. If I change my mind, you can. And that little section in Ezra we talked about was very important because that's what allowed them to come back. So if a law was written correctly, it could be changed. So perhaps this irrevocability was only a problem with hastily created laws. And we see that here, right? This one was hastily created. We see that in Daniel. It was hastily created. So that may have been why it wasn't an issue that Herodotus really heard about, because it didn't come up that often. And is it really that hard for us to imagine a hastily created law that is difficult or impossible to repeal? Healthcare, anybody? I mean, we see it around us. It's not that hard to imagine. The command in verse 22 is curious. That every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. The traditional view is that the king ordered everyone to speak only their father's native language in their house as part of this decree, which some have argued is kind of an odd decree for the Persian king. Why would he do that? Now, the New International Version, and those of you who've been in my classes know I'm not a big fan of that particular version, it solves the problem by just rewriting the verse. It just rewrites it and says, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. That's not what the verse says. That's not what it says. So I don't think we should just start rewriting it when we have a difficulty, as the NIV does, not just there, but many times. The most likely reason for the edict is that the use of the man's language in his own home was a sign of his leadership in that home. He was using his own language in the home. And doesn't that fit the context here well? Why is this edict being sent out? Because the king was worried that all the other wives would act like Vashti did. So as part of the edict, he says, okay, in your home, you're going to speak the husband's language in your home. It's a sign of his leadership. And I think that's why this was included. It's ironic, though, isn't it, when we look here? By accepting this advice, the king ended up publicizing his embarrassing plight to the entire empire. After this was over, everybody knew about what had happened to the king. Afraid that all the women in the empire would hear about what Vashti had done, he ends up assuring that all of the women in the empire would hear about what Queen Vashti had done. He publicizes it to everybody. They all heard about it. As we've already noted, Esther is one of the funniest books in the Bible. And we see here, I think, kind of a humorous scene about the King Xerxes wanting to, you know, being embarrassed and ending up publicizing it to the entire empire. Yes, there is humor in the Bible. Anyone that thinks otherwise just hasn't spent much time with the Bible. There's humor in the Bible. But is humor appropriate in a book that deals with the near genocide of God's people? Well, keep in mind when this book was written. Anyone picking up this book and reading it already knew how it turned out. They already knew it had a happy ending. So, yes, I think it was appropriate, certainly from that standpoint. Another possibility may have been what Byron said, if I laugh at any mortal thing, so I may not weep, because that's another possibility. But for whatever reason, there is humor throughout the book of Esther. And I think we see it here also. At the end of chapter 1, where are we? Queen Vashti has courageously exited the scene. She has prepared the way for one to replace her and perhaps even exceed that courage. Does the Bible denigrate women, as some argue? Hardly, hardly. No religion has done more for the status of women than Christianity and the Judaism that preceded it. No religion. Just look around the world today at, for instance, the Muslim religions and how they treat women. And compare. Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. The phrase "after these things" in verse 1 doesn't tell us how much more later it was that these events occurred. Verse 16 will tell us that Esther came before the king in his seventh year, which would be 4 years after the events in chapter 1. Well, what happened in between the fourth year and the seventh year? The disastrous Greek campaign. We skipped right over it here. It happened in between. Anybody reading this book originally would have known that. They would have known what had happened in between. That loss depleted the king's treasuries. And we're going to see an appeal to his greed here in a moment. That loss discredited him in the eyes of his subjects. And we're going to see an assassination attempt in just a moment. That's what's going on in the background, that disastrous Greek campaign. It seems from verse 1 that the king regretted his decision against Queen Vashti, but it had been irrevocable. So that's why we see the search for the replacement. On the surface, this search sounds like a beauty contest. But for the women involved, it would have not, did not have been a pleasant experience at all. They would have been uprooted from their homes and taken to live in the king's harem. A Persian king could have had any woman he wanted, and history tells us about the suffering that caused. Herodotus also reports that 500 young boys were taken each year and castrated to serve as eunuchs in the Persian court. According to Herodotus, Persian kings found their wives from among the most noble families, and also their wives among the families of their seven closest advisors. That was what they normally did. You have to wonder if maybe that's why those seven closest advisors were so concerned about getting Queen Vashti off the scene, because they thought maybe one of their relatives might be the next queen. It's a possibility. But Plutarch tells us that sometimes the Persian kings would go outside those groups to find their wives. And as we're about to see, that's what Xerxes is about to do also. Verses 5 through 9. Of the 16 people mentioned by name in chapter 1, only King Xerxes remains to be mentioned by name. The Jews are mentioned for the first time in verse 5. And it's interesting that they are spoken of in the third person when they're mentioned. One commentator suggests the author was a Jew, but he may have written as if he were not a Jew. He may have written this as a Persian court chronicle, as if it were written by a Persian. For whatever reason, the Jews are introduced as that other group over there. The phrase who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. That phrase can either refer back to Mordecai or to Kish, carried away. If it referred to Mordecai, it would mean Mordecai was 120 years old. So I think it has to refer to his grandfather, Kish. Kish had been carried away when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. The author is very clearly associating Mordecai with another Benjamite. Another Benjamite who also had a relative named Kish. That's King Saul. He's associating Mordecai with King Saul. And we're going to see why that's so important when we meet Haman, the villain. Because Haman comes from a very distinct group of people that had something to do with King Saul when we get there. So keep that in mind. In verse 7, we finally meet Esther. Mordecai had adopted her after her parents had died. She was his cousin. Esther's the only person in the book who we're told had two names. And it was not uncommon for Jews to have two names, one a Jewish name and one the name from the place where they'd been taken. Hadassah means myrtle. Esther could either mean the Persian word for star, or it could come from the goddess Ishtar, goddess of love and war. Perhaps by mentioning both names, the author is stressing that she's going to have two identities. She's going to be torn between these two identities. Is she the Persian queen, or is she the Jewish daughter? We'll see. Commentators differ about how many women were brought before the king. Josephus says there were 400. The phrase Esther also was taken. This author is so careful not to let us in on what she's thinking. We see the passive tense there. Was she taken against her will? Was she reluctant to be taken? Was she looking forward? I mean, we don't know. We do know, though, that the same passive voice is used in chapter 2, verse 6 to describe the captives who were taken from Jerusalem. We certainly know how they felt about that. So that may be a clue as to how Esther felt. But the passive voice is used throughout Esther, and in a sense to show us that these people are being propelled along by things outside their control. The passive voice is used here. But there's a strong note of irony, perhaps even humor again in verse 9. The man who was pleased by Esther, whose favor she won, was Haggai, the eunuch. As one commentator wrote, Esther's beauty was overwhelming even to a eunuch. Some wonder why Esther did not protest against eating the unclean food, as Daniel did. And although the text gives us no answer, we're going to see the bigger reason why in a moment, and that was she was instructed not to disclose her identity. Verses 10 through 14. We're not told why Mordecai told Esther not to conceal her identity. We're not told why, even though it would almost certainly have caused her to compromise her fidelity to the law. She would have to do things that she otherwise would not have done because that would have given away her identity. Some suggest it may have been because she would have had no chance of becoming queen had her identity been known. But does that then mean that Mordecai was acting out of ambition? Perhaps Mordecai knew, or maybe he was made to know, that Esther as queen would be in a much better position to help her people, and that she would not become queen unless she concealed her identity. So maybe we see again the providence of God acting here. Another possibility is that it might have been very dangerous to her to reveal her identity. We see anti-Semitism in this book on a grand scale. Haman is about to be insulted by one Jew, and what does he do? He's going to try to wipe out the entire Jewish race. That's anti-Semitism on a grand scale, so perhaps Esther had a good reason at this point to conceal her identity. Mordecai checked on her every day. He was very concerned about Esther. Verses 12 through 14 reveal the process by which the girls would be presented to the king. Apparently, most of them would spend only a single night with the king. And after that, they would move into the harem, the concubine. There was no guarantee the king would ever call them again, which would mean they would spend the rest of their lives there in that harem. As one commentator described it, perpetual widowhood. After one night with the king, most of them would live the rest of their lives secluded in that harem. The author is showing us here that the odds are stacked against Esther. She's not a Persian, she's a Jew. She's hiding her identity. And that's odds stacked against her right there. But then the odds were stacked against all of them, right? Because the odds were that they would be called one time and then never see the king again. The odds are stacked against them. What will happen, though? How could such a marginalized person in a hostile world ever make a difference for God? Only by a great reversal. We're going to see that. Verses 15 through 18. We need to pause here and consider a very important question. We've only hinted at so far a little bit. And that is Esther portrayed here as a positive example or a negative example? For many, the question itself is surprising, isn't it? Is there any doubt that Esther is a positive role model here? Well, yes, there is some doubt, at least by some. And remember, the author has carefully concealed what Esther was thinking. He's concealed her motivations from us. We see her actions, but we're not told why she did that. And she does seem to rise to her high position differently than Daniel did, doesn't she? Daniel rose up by his constant obedience to the law. Do we really see that here with Esther? Here's what one modern commentator said on this issue. How would you use this episode from Esther's life to teach virtue to your teenage daughter? What message would she get? Make yourself as attractive as possible to powerful men? Use your body to advance God's kingdom? The end justifies the means? Did Esther initially hide her identity rather than face persecution, as some suggest? Did she engage in situational ethics? We know she's about to take a very courageous stand. We know that. But is she being courageous here as well? Here's one very harsh quote from a 15th century Jewish commentator. Now, when Mordecai heard the king's herald announcing that whoever had a daughter or a sister should bring her to the king to have intercourse with an uncircumcised heathen, why did he not risk his life to take her to some deserted place to hide until the danger would pass? He should have been killed rather than submit to such an act. Why did Mordecai not keep righteous Esther from idol worship? Why was he not more careful? Where was his righteousness, his piety, his valor? Esther, too, should by right have tried to commit suicide before allowing herself to have intercourse with Xerxes. The author of Esther makes no attempt to vindicate her. He doesn't explain extenuating circumstances. He doesn't report that she's secretly operating under God's special command. He doesn't tell us these things. Now, later Greek versions, I told you they added stuff to the text. They add all that in. And if you read one of the Greek versions, you'll see that Esther had made to announce at some point, "I abhor the bed of the uncircumcised." That's in the Greek version. That's not in the Bible version. That's not in the true version. The reader is left to decide. Is Esther wholly righteous Is she maybe partly righteous, mainly righteous? Although we're not without clues, the Bible does not answer that question. Either here or elsewhere, you will look in vain for Esther's name among the roll call of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. It's not there. So what is the answer? I think the answer is somewhere in between there. We definitely see Esther's righteousness. We definitely see her courage in this book. But we may also see some of the other side. And is that really that surprising? How many Old Testament characters are presented as solely righteous? Don't we also see the warts? Don't we more often than not see negative qualities mixed in with the positive? And remember something important here. All of the Jews in this account are here for only one reason, because they did not go back to Jerusalem. They stayed behind. So we're already seeing some negative mixed in with the positive just from that fact alone. As for the intercourse with Xerxes, I think that Jewish scholar had at least one thing right. It would have cost her her life to refuse that. It would have cost her her life. And I can think we can see that God did not want Esther to pay that price, because he had some other plans for her. This was his providence working through Esther. The ultimate answer to the question of Esther's character is to see the providence of God working through her. Whether righteous or not, God was able to use her to advance his plans. And when the time for decision finally came, she made the right decision, didn't she? And that, too, is a message for us as well. If we, perhaps like Esther, look back on some of our life with some regret, as maybe Esther did, we need to remember that it's never too late to do the right thing. And when the time came for her to act, she did the right thing. After the 12-month beauty treatment in verse 12, Esther is finally taken in before the king in verses 15 through 18. She took with her only what Haggai suggested, perhaps trusting that he knew what would please the king. The 10th month would have been the cold and wet month in the middle of the winter. The 7th year, as we mentioned, would have been 479 B.C., after the Greek expedition. Verse 17 is a key verse in the narrative. King Xerxes made Esther queen instead of Vashti. This sudden decision suggests he was overwhelmed by her beauty. But I think we also see the providence of God at action here, don't we? God is pulling his strings just as he pulled Cyrus's strings and Darius's strings. God is in control here. The author avoids the use of the word marriage, although that would have been implied. At least it would have been implied after their first night together. It's interesting to note that Jewish Esther married Gentile Xerxes, and this was taking place at the very same time that Nehemiah and Ezra, as we'll see soon, are preaching against intermarriage. When we return to Ezra 9 and 10, we're going to see Ezra's harsh condemnation of mixed marriages and his insistence that they divorce. How would Ezra have judged this Jewish queen? What was Esther thinking about all this? We don't know. Had she been swept off her feet by the attention of this all-powerful ruler? Or was she wondering why God had allowed such a horrible thing to happen to her? We're not told. To celebrate, the king gave a great feast, and he granted a remission of taxes, which no doubt caused the people to love Esther as much as he now did. It's a very timely remission as we sit here, as we're studying here the day before tax day. It's interesting to note how often the people of God in the Old Testament found themselves in the royal courts. Joseph, Moses, Daniel, Esther. As Christians, we should never shy away from such opportunities. Who knows, but they may have come to us for such a time as this. For those who don't believe that God's people should ever be involved in politics, I'm glad they didn't convince Esther of that. I'm glad they didn't convince Joseph of that. I'm glad they didn't convince Daniel of that. Next week, we'll pick up in verse 19. I'm probably going to have to pick up steam a little bit because I've only gotten through a little into chapter 2. We don't have that much time for Esther. So we'll pick up the steam a little bit. Please read on into the next two or three chapters at least, and next week we'll pick up there in verse 19. Thank you very much for your attention.